You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today, I'm really pleased because our topic today is one that should interest and concern everyone. If you care about the quality and cost of food, especially meat, which is our specific topic today, these times of increasing inflation and grocery bills, you'll really want to hear from our guest today on how we got to this point in the meat industry specifically. He's Christopher Leonard. He's a former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press, and he's the author of three books. I had him as a guest a couple of years ago on his latest book. This one goes back a little further, but I think you'll agree when you hear this that this is very relevant to today. The book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. It's got some important local connections that you'll hear about during this interview. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Like all great books, I think, especially when you're following a story with historical implications, it's a story of individual people and one person in particular who you call a genius in this book. Talk about Don Tyson. Our listeners will know the last name. Talk about him and how he was played a role in this transformation of the American food industry.
I will. And I mean, that's the perfect place to start. I mean, you know, the book is about Tyson Foods, which is the biggest meat company in the United States. They make about 1/5 of all the meat we eat. They have tremendous control in rural communities, control over farmers, control over the meat system. But I mean, this sounds like a cliche to say it had humble beginnings. But when you turn the clock back to how this empire was built, you go back to 1930 in the tiny town of Springdale, Arkansas, which was at that time a marginal town in a relatively poor state during the Great Depression. I mean, it was hard times. And there was this guy down there named John Tyson, okay? This is Don Tyson's father, who ran a small regional chicken company. And this was a really interesting time for raising meat back in the early 1930s because researchers and scientists were really starting to figure out how to raise chickens in particular on a large scale. Like they industrialized the system. They started raising these birds in these big barns and figuring out how to slaughter them really quickly, like in a big factory. And so John Tyson started a company that was relatively small that would ship chickens up to Kansas City and Chicago. And his son Don grew up in this environment in this small town, really defined by poverty. And Don was working from the minute he could walk is really how I'd put it. He was in his dad's shadow, working all the time. And then, you know, you fast forward to the year 1967 when John Tyson dies and Don Tyson takes over this company. And in short, this guy, Don Tyson, the reason I call him a genius, even though I don't mean to be simplistic, but there was a lot about Don Tyson that was cruel. He was a cruel man who grew up in a hard environment. No one had ever given him anything, and I don't think he felt like he had to give anybody anything. This is a guy who believed in brutal competition, you know, getting whatever you can get, however you can get it. And that character really defined the DNA of this company he took over, Tyson Foods. But the genius is what he did with it. I mean, he expanded the company. He was very brilliant about buying out his competitors, which is actually a lot harder than it sounds. You got to figure out how much that other company's worth, where you want to go, making these huge deals. He built up and built up and built up Tyson Foods by purchasing competitors. But he really was a visionary in the sense that he realized by about the 1980s, that because Tyson Foods was such an industrial company, I mean, the chicken was like a widget on a factory line. I mean, they engineered up this bird to grow as much breast meat as possible. They had the slaughterhouse process down to a fine-tuned process. They raised the animals in what we would call today a chicken house or a factory farm, but it was these huge complexes with automatic ventilation, automatic feeding systems, computer control. And what Don realized was they were raising meat more effectively and more cheaply than in any other sector, particularly beef and pork, the other two major meats. And at that time in the 80s, chicken wasn't really on fast food menus. I mean, you had Burger King, you had McDonald's, but Don realized if you can make it cheaper and at a higher volume than any other meat, the customer's going to come to you. And he spent years courting McDonald's, flying up to Illinois, telling them, you got to put chicken on the menu, you got to put chicken on the menu. And then when these food scientists at McDonald's figured out how to make the holy grail of modern technology, otherwise known as the chicken McNugget, when they figured out how to do that, Don was like, guess what? I've got entire towns that do nothing but raise birds that can be turned into chicken nuggets at your specification and delivered to your door. And he truly built a global empire. And to me, it's so remarkable. You've got a kid from a small town, educated, I think, up through high school, and he did go to the University of Arkansas, but he seemed completely comfortable at the apex of power at this massive corporation. He was familiar and comfortable with President Bill Clinton. He would walk into the White House. And it's pretty extraordinary, I think, to make that kind of journey in one lifetime, you know, from rural poverty to that much power.
Talk about vertical integration. It's an important concept, a legal concept, business concept that plays an important role later in our discussion.
Absolutely. Vertical integration is kind of the secret sauce to Tyson Foods. I mean, it's the way that they can make chicken so effectively at such large scale. And I need to hasten to point out, like, you know, one of the big points of this book is that today the meat industry is more consolidated than at any point in U.S. history, meaning a handful of companies control more of the industry, and it's a smaller group of companies than ever before. And that's partly because of the mergers I just mentioned. Okay. Two companies make half the chicken in America. That's Tyson and Pilgrim's Pride. By contrast, back in the 70s, half the market was divided up amongst about 38 companies. Now it's two, okay? You call mergers in the economy world, you call it horizontal integration when you buy out your competitors. But vertical integration is the key here. And here's what it is. You know, back in the 50s, when you had a town that produced a lot of chicken, you had all these independent businesses. You had the farms, you had a feed mill business. You had a slaughterhouse, probably a mom-and-pop slaughterhouse. You had trucking lines. You had companies that did nothing but specialize in the genetics of the birds. They would breed birds at hatcheries and raise the best birds. Under vertical integration, all those businesses are now swallowed up into one corporate entity. So you go to a Tyson Foods town today, and there's one massive complex with the feed mill, the hatchery, the slaughterhouse. They ship their birds out to these farms that they run. So you've got supposedly independent farmers who own their land, but they raise birds under very demanding specifications for Tyson. And also, I need to point out, Tyson always owns the chickens, it owns the feeds, it employs the veterinarians who care for the birds. That's vertical integration. It's all under one corporate roof. And that's what makes the consolidation today so powerful, is that you've got fewer companies, but they also control the business from top to bottom. I mean, I was at this office of Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale, Arkansas, and it looked like a big floor of cubicles you might see at a software firm or an insurance company, but it was where all these data people were running about 5,000 farms. You know, they were running the operations, figuring out how many birds were going to go out, what kind of birds, how long they were going to live. it's all controlled from a central office. And to kind of close up, like what vertical integration allows was that moment when Dunn Tyson goes to McDonald's and he says, you want to make chicken McNuggets at a huge scale around the clock at every store in the country, we can deliver the exact kind of bird you need at the volumes you want, at the spot that you want, because they control everything from the central headquarters. So it makes it tremendously efficient from an economic point of view.
Excuse me, you referred to it as the chickenization of America. And then he takes this model into other meat industries.
Yes. And that, what you just mentioned, the chickenization really starts in the 1990s. And chickenization is a term actually coined by farmers. So they're talking about what the chicken industry looks like when it's completely vertically integrated and controlled by companies. And again, I've got to restate, like, the chicken that you and I eat never, ever goes out onto an open market. It's owned by Tyson its entire lifetime. It's processed. It's sold to the wholesaler. But the other meat industries were very different, particularly the hog industry, which even in the 1990s, the hog industry was still dominated by independent farmers who raised all kinds of different hogs. They experimented on quality. They owned their farms. There's actually quite a bit of money in it. You could make good money raising hogs in Iowa. I met folks in Iowa who were put through law school on hog farm money. And it was a very profitable industry. And the people inside Tyson realized, if we apply this vertically integrated chicken model to hogs, we can take over the hog industry. And that is exactly what they did. During the 90s, you know, I was kicking around as a daily reporter down in Columbia, Missouri at the time. And you might remember this when all those big factory hog farms just kind of started appearing in the 90s. That was a corporate takeover. It was these companies like Tyson getting a lot of investor money and building hog farms that raise the hogs under contract instead of selling them on the open market. And they literally wiped out the entire independent hog farmer economy. I think now north of 90% of all hogs are raised under contract, and it has been fully chickenized. And you know, we'll get into this, but much to the detriment and the chagrin of the hog farmer, who's lost their independence. And when people talk about chickenization, when hog farmers or cattle ranchers talk about chickenization, really a lot of what they're referring to is the life of your modern day contract poultry grower who lives under the thumb of the company like Tyson that does their contract and dictates terms and pay. And it is a very, very hard life for those contract farmers. And that's exactly the role that hog farmers have now found themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm old enough to remember going back where families didn't eat chicken that often. You might have fried chicken. I remember in the 60s, and I was just talking about this with a family member about your book last night. I said, I remember that. You rarely had chicken to eat. And I remember two hogs. You'd drive around here in rural Illinois where I live, and you'd see hogs out in enclosed facilities. You never see hogs out anymore because they're in these factory type farms and in these confinement buildings. But let's get right to the impact on people's food bill. Food prices go up, but it's certainly not going to the farmers.
Like, scientifically proven, it's not going to the farmers. Farmers used to get north of 50 cents on the dollar that we spent on food at the grocery store. And now they get, depending on the crop, you know, 24 cents or even less. That profit margin goes to the big meat producers like Tyson Foods or Pilgrim's Pride. And the way I describe it is when an industry becomes incredibly consolidated as the meat industry is today, it gives these companies market power. They're far more immune to competition, to the laws of supply and demand. And when you have that kind of market power, you know, human nature is to exercise the power and use it. And the playbook of a monopoly is always the same. You push down prices that you pay to producers, which in this case is farmers, and then you raise prices for consumers, and you capture the profit in the middle. And that is exactly to the T what we've been seeing in the meat industry. And to back up a little bit, it was really a change in public policy starting around the 1980s in antitrust law. And, you know, antitrust law is the body of law that over competition in America. It was written to curb the power of monopolies. But we changed our thinking around antitrust law in the 80s and said, okay, we adopted this thing called the consumer welfare standard, which is if you can prove you're making products more cheaply, we don't care how consolidated the business is. We used to like to have a lot of competitors, but we decided in the 80s, we don't care. You can become totally consolidated as long as you're proven you can make the product more cheaply. That's what allowed this huge wave of mergers in the 90s. I mean, Tyson was buying up the number four chicken company, then the number three, then the number two, and just becoming a giant. And what it led to is that since about 2008 to 2010, you've been seeing this like steady upward predictable stair step price of chicken. And of course there's ups and downs. I mean, there are definitely, you know, chicken prices today are down compared to where they were. But when you back up and look at that graph over 10 years, the price is steadily rising all the time. And I'm not going to say interesting. What's really dramatic is that starting in about 2018, federal regulators began to push back against this consolidation and push back against the price hikes. And the Department of Justice sued Tyson Foods for colluding with its with the other companies, which I don't even really consider competitors at this point, but it started colluding with its competitors to raise prices to wholesalers. And Tyson actually won that case on a mistrial, but the case unearthed text messages between Tyson and other companies talking about what the price was going to be. I've done a story about a software system that Tyson uses called AgriStats that's shared by all the chicken companies where they can see what every other company is paying farmers, which helps them depress that price that they're paying to farmers. And the concentration in this business is a huge cause of not just the price hikes, but, you know, the uniform quality. Another way you can hike the price is by charging the same price and reducing quality. And you see that all the time. And the big reason for that is that when you walk into the grocery store and you see 14 different brand names of chicken, they're really all produced by at most four companies, probably two companies, depending on where you are. And without that competition, they can keep raising the price.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Chris Leonard, who's author of a book we're talking about here, very important book with local, pretty big implications locally in Illinois and Iowa and in our region. It's called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. It's about Tyson Foods. And I would add that there's a Tyson facilities on both sides of the river in Columbus Junction, Iowa, and Joslyn, Illinois. Chris, I want to talk about, you mentioned antitrust, and obviously whatever antitrust measures were tried were failed, but there's a local angle here too, where Iowa's former state attorney general, Tom Miller, tried to take on this concentration in the meat industry. How did that go?
You know, it was a fascinating story. You know, Tom Miller's office, this is going to seem like a no-brainer to you, but I mean, the thing about politicians in Iowa is they care about farming and they care about farmers. And I mean, we can debate all day long about whether the policies are good or bad for farmers at times, but I mean, the concern is front and center. And Tom Miller's office, the Attorney General of Iowa, back in the 90s, saw what was happening in the hog industry. And started to hear more and more stories about these hog farmers who went under contract and then realized what a bad deal it was. Same thing, exact same story you see with chicken farmers. The company would, change the terms on them, give them shorter term contracts, force them into pay regimes that shifted more of the risk to the farmer. So Tom Miller took legal action against one of the largest pork companies at the time, when there was a buyout of Murphy Family Farms. And the company was purchased by Smithfield. And what was so important about that was it was going to be a huge leap forward in vertical integration. In other words, Murphy Family Farms owned all these farms. Smithfield owned the slaughterhouse. It was going to close that loop in a huge way. You know, needless to say, Smithfield Foods fought back and had a ton of money to fight back, had, you know, whole office building floors full of lawyers. And what was interesting to me was Tom Miller ultimately was pushing for competition and transparency. And he covered a lot of ground in Iowa. And for example, he made it so that hog companies had to make public their contracts so that farmers knew if they were getting the same terms as other farmers or if they were getting worse terms. But at the end of the day, Miller could not block that merger. And what was astounding to me was that Premium Standard Farms just went ahead with the merger before Miller could review it anyway. And then so Miller was fighting this kind of rear guard action. But they did end up not stopping that merger. And most of the ill effects of vertical integration did take place after that in the following years.
The other interesting local angle was some possible momentum for doing something about this occurred during the Iowa caucuses in 2008 involving a senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. Can you kind of, if you can, in just a couple minutes, kind of encapsulate that story for our listeners?
You know, it was shocking. I mean, you know, Miller's effort didn't stop the train of vertical integration in the 90s. So then by 2008, when Barack Obama is running to be president as kind of like the insurgent candidate, it's amazing when you go back and look at the speeches Obama was given in these small towns. He was railing against consolidation. He was talking about getting more competition for the farmer, and he won in Iowa. If you remember, he won the Iowa caucuses. It was huge momentum for him, and the farm vote was a big part of that. When Obama became president, he initiated one of the most aggressive and sweeping antitrust reform efforts we've had in the meat industry since the New Deal. And this was in 2010. And Obama, the administration with Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, who's back in that same job again today, they held a series of public hearings around the country in the Farm Belt mostly. That partnered Vilsack at USDA with Eric Holder from the Department of Justice. And they said, okay, we're going to come up with new rules. We're going to try to increase competition and make rules with more transparency, more fairness for the farmer. And I mean, I hate to say it, but the real blunt reality is that that effort in 2010 collapsed entirely. The meat industry lobbyists demolished the reform effort, and it sputtered out entirely, which kind of did more harm than good, because after that time, the monopolistic behavior only intensified. I mean, my book came out in 2014, and unfortunately, everything it describes is true today, honestly, if not worse, in terms of the way farmers are treated, prices are hiked. But I will say, sitting here in 2024, there is a changing of the tide. I mean, it was the Trump administration Department of Justice that sued Tyson Foods for colluding and raising prices. I should say allegedly colluding, because Tyson won that case, but the text messages showed a lot of coordination. The text messages that were revealed in court, I should say. But the changing of the tide is significant now, in the Department of Justice is taking a lot harder stance. Antitrust regulators at USDA are trying to impose new rules, and I think they successfully will impose new rules. So it's not like it's a static story. It's definitely changing.
Yeah, time for one more question here with Chris Leonard. In fact, you answered the one I was going to ask. Has anything changed in the last 10 years? And you just answered this, but what's been the impact on rural Iowa, rural America, from the chickenization of the meat industry over the last 50 years?
I'll just be blunt with you. I think it's awful. You know, raising meat is still an economic pillar of many rural communities. And when we talk about poultry farmers, I really do think, and hog farmers, modern hog farmers, I mean, these are folks that I consider more like small factory owners. I mean, they're borrowing $2.5 to $3 million to build these big complexes. They work really hard. But when there's a lack of competition, the money you can earn from your hard work becomes less and less every year. And I mean, I'm seeing it constantly with poultry farmers and hog farmers, that the price they get for the animals they raise isn't determined by supply and demand or quality. It's determined by the market power and the bargaining power of these consolidated giant corporations. And it has taken tremendous amounts of wealth out of rural communities, and it's taken control away from farmers. And to close, I got to say, like, it wasn't that long ago in Iowa that hogs were raised by independent producers. They kept the earnings from their hard work. We had super high quality animals, and there was nothing wrong with that. Well, sure, nothing's perfect, but I mean, that system worked. That system worked with competition. And so, you know, I think the effects of this monopoly power have really been bad for rural communities.
The book, again, is called The Meat Racket. The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business by Chris Leonard. Chris, didn't I see where you got a new book coming out?
No, I'm working on a new book now, but okay, with the lead time of this stuff, it's going to be a few years. But so.
Okay. Well, I misread that then. But this book and the Lords of Finance that you wrote are both the Lords of Easy Money. I'm sorry. Are both excellent books on the modern economy. And I would say you were very prescient on the Lords of Easy Money in the end. But thank you again for being our guest today on Heartland Politics. And I'll definitely get you back. By the way, Chris is a fellow Midwesterner. So he's got preference for coming back on the show.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.